Speaking of real good lawyers, we have Michael Leonard in studio today on his birthday, nonetheless, and we're going to be talking about criminal cases that are in the news. Are you ready to go, Mike?
I'm ready to go. Let's do it.
Let's do it. Okay, let's start with the CEO of UnitedHealthcare was shot and killed almost a year to the day today. Was shot and killed in Manhattan following a nationwide manhunt. A 27-year-old Luigi Mangione was arrested in Pennsylvania. The state of New York is charging him, as is the federal government. This week, he was in a Manhattan court with his lawyers and the prosecutors. Mike, tell us what was going on and how important is what is going on in the court to the case and the prosecution.
Sure. So he was arrested in Altoona, Pennsylvania, about 5 days after the shooting. And so what happened is a manager at McDonald's was told by a bunch of people, hey, we think that's the Luigi Mangione guy, because even though he was wearing a covering over his face, his eyebrows were so distinctive.
Yes.
So you heard the tape in the hearing being played. And so she reported that. It brought out the police. So what they're trying to litigate right now is whether any of the evidence seized from Mangione at the McDonald's and in connection with his arrest will be suppressed. And most notably, he had a backpack with him, which was next to him, which had the gun, which was a 3D printed gun, which is pretty amazing. It also had what people are calling his manifesto, which is like his notes, basically saying, I hate the healthcare system. I hate people in healthcare. I'm going to go shoot somebody at a conference. Couldn't be better evidence
right.
for the prosecution. But what happened was the officers go there, they approach this guy, and some of the testimony, makes the officers look kind of bad, because one of them was testifying about how he was so clear in his mind this wasn't going to be Mangione. They were betting hoagie sandwiches on whether it was going to be him or not. The gist of it is they go in there, they approach him, and he volunteers to talk to them for about a good 10 to 13 minutes, which there was nothing wrong with the police continuing to engage with him. He gave him a fake ID, gave him a fake name, all sorts of stuff. He never, from my reading of it, he never really invoked his right to counsel. At one point, after quite a dialogue, he said he didn't want to speak, but then he re-engaged with them, but he never asked for a lawyer. But the key issue is, the search of the backpack. So they don't arrest him for about maybe 13 to 19 minutes. And then after that, that's when they search the backpack. And so there's kind of contrary positions the government's taken in that case. On the one hand, the officers are saying, the one key officer testified, I knew it was him right away. Okay. Yet he waited 13 minutes to separate him from the backpack and waited that long distance of time to then search the backpack. Under Pennsylvania law, it's my understanding he could have searched it if there was a public safety issue that the officer was potentially in danger. So it's hard to make the argument on the one hand, I knew immediately it was him. And then their actions belie that. And then to say, well, we still had this significant safety concern that caused us and forced us to search the backpack right then and there.
So let me just parse this. So at some point, so the argument from Mangione's standpoint is you should have got a warrant.
Correct.
You should have had a warrant, and unless like the bomb's going to go off or you're afraid he's going to take a gun out and shoot you, if that evidence was in there and they didn't get a warrant and it was improper, then they don't get to use that at trial.
Correct. So
which is a big problem.
Of course. I mean, when you have the gun and the document basically laying out, here's what I'm going to do, those are significant pieces of evidence. However, there's a couple factors to consider. Number one, do I think the judge will probably lean over backwards to say that it was appropriate? Yes, I do. And number two, even if that evidence is suppressed, which is highly significant stuff, there's still a heck of a lot of evidence to,
sure.
to be used in this case. It's not like the case is going to go away. One of the key pieces of evidence was him actually in the youth hostel or hostel he was staying at in New York, lowering his mask and identifying his facial features. That's what led to, the good composite sketch of him. And they were able to track him by cameras and all sorts of stuff to not to Altoona, but to location after location. They're able to put him in that area. However, putting him in the area is different than saying he's the shooter. So clearly it's a highly significant motion to suppress hearing.
And wasn't there also an issue of not giving him his Miranda rights?
Correct. So
at what point, and maybe to educate our listeners, I mean, this is something you litigate all the time as a criminal defense lawyer. At what point does a police officer have to give you the rights?
Well, when you're under arrest, right? That's a point that point at which they have to give them. And here, you know, the problem for Mangione is that he voluntarily engaged with them for a significant period of time. He was voluntarily answering their questions, engaging with them. He didn't have to do that. He could have said, no, I'm going to remain silent, or he could have invoked the right to counsel, which then would have stopped all the questioning. So they appropriately, in my view, talked to him, engaged with him, because he voluntarily answered their questions and showed a willingness to continue to answer the questions. And then eventually they did place him under arrest. That's the key time for the backpack issue, because they're taking the position that even though he was under arrest at that point in time, we still had a significant public safety concern with the backpack and danger to ourselves, which don't strike as totally credible in light of the fact that they're simultaneously saying we knew it was him right away. So if it gets suppressed, huge blow to the prosecution, but let's not get ahead of ourselves because there's plenty of other evidence they're going to introduce.
Let's talk a little bit about this wild aspect of this case. And I just want to be clear that nothing that I say today means that I condone what he did, or if you have a problem with the insurance industry or the healthcare industry, that you should just go shoot someone in the back on a street in Manhattan, because that's not the way you handle your grievances in our society. But there are a lot of people out there who are sort of advocating for him. And I saw that apparently he has garnered $1.3 million from people, random people donating to his defense fund. And he's gotten over 6,000 letters, you know, approving of what he did, or at least, you know, and addressing him and dealing with him. So there's this kind of cult following. And how do you play into that as a defense lawyer? And how does the prosecution deal with it? And is it possible you could get a jury that would acquit him, even though it's pretty good, there's pretty good evidence he did it?
You definitely can. I mean, obviously, that's going to be a key issue for jury selection and trying to figure out to what degree people have been exposed to information about the case. It's hard to find people that are not when it's this much of a public case. However, you know, let's not forget, we have all sorts of huge, high-profile cases all the time. And generally, we can get a jury that can be fair and impartial despite the mass monumental publicity. This case is different and weird in several respects. Like you said, there's such an outcry against the healthcare industry in general that these people rallied to his defense as if, okay, we all hate the healthcare system, it's okay to gun down someone on the street, which is bizarre in my view, right?
Yeah.
But add to it, you know, if Mangione was a scrabble haired guy who was maybe 40, 50, or near my age, and wasn't a good-looking guy, young, presentable, with an Ivy League education, there might not be the same support for him. But we have this bizarre social media aspect of these large press cases, which is certainly playing into it. He actually, I think, was a mistake, but the judge lets him dress for court. Even though there's no jury, he allows him to not appear in his, you know, jail clothes. He allows him to dress. And then that gets reported on and pictures get taken. And that feeds the frenzy of the social media, this good-looking young guy who's been allegedly falsely accused by his follower. So it has a lot of dynamics of a high-impact press case. It'll be tried in New York in federal and or state court, maybe both. And so I still believe you can get a fair jury. It's just you have a much greater challenge. And like a lot of reporters have said, the sort of sleeper juror that, you know, is your worst nightmare, where you don't know that their views about the healthcare system are so strong that they might do anything to acquit.
To get on the jury. Yeah.
To get on and to acquit and not tell their fair views. You
including
know?
Fib a little bit to be that person who can do that justice in that person's mind.
Exactly.
Very interesting. You know, just before we get into these topics, I just saw in my news feed, only 17% of Americans rate lawyers as highly honest. And we are just right below, or actually right above, politicians and car salesmen and on those types of people. You've been doing this a long time. Why do we get such a bad rap?
It's a tough question. I mean, that's been historically the case going back for decades. You know, lawyer jokes have always been big. I kind of relate it to this idea, like when you think of everyone hates Congress, but they elect their congressmen.
Yes.
Everyone says they generally hate lawyers, but I'll tell you what, I get a lot of calls from friends, family, friends of friends, whatever, when you need a lawyer, and they appreciate your work. So I think it's kind of like based upon your own experience versus your inclination towards lawyer as a whole. But, you know, the kind of the way we're portrayed, you know, it's all about winning and losing, which is true, right? And some of the TV shows and things of that nature. So I think it's something we've been fighting against for a long, long time. I don't think it's anything particularly new.
No, I don't either. And I do see, you know, a couple of bad apples will spoil it for everybody. And, you know, lawyers can be pugnacious and oppositional. And I also think there's a power issue because, you know, our system should be a little more user-friendly to people, but it just isn't. Even in a simple divorce, you need a lawyer. And it's expensive as hell to hire a lawyer to divide up your stuff and make sure your kids are taken care of. And I think people resent that. And I totally understand that.
So. Yeah, I think that, you know, you and I and other lawyers, we can evaluate our opponent and saying they're doing their job. They're doing the appropriate things they need to try to win or put their client's best interests at heart. However, the client may have a very different view of that. That person is a whatever, right? Because
yes.
Even though they're doing their job, they certainly don't look at it that way. And they think they're being too aggressive or they're being unfair to them. So, you know, they're taking all that into account rather than us kind of dispassionately saying, oh, he's just doing their job. It's hard to say that to a client that the other lawyer is just doing their job when they're attacking them.
Of course, of course. Let's talk about Derek Chauvin. Derek Chauvin was the former Minnesota police officer who was convicted of killing George Floyd in 2020. It's been all that time. He's filed a new appeal. He's 4.5 years into a 22-year sentence in both state and federal court. Can you tell us the gist of this appeal? And I think, you know, reading part of the appeal, there's a provision in there that basically says now the hysteria is gone. I think the courts need to be more dispassionate and look at the facts of this case rather than the cause.
Sure. And I think what the point they're trying to make is that there's not this great public outcry. There's not this attention on the case. We can sort of step back, take a breath and see if the legal arguments are legitimate or not. I wasn't real impressed with what I read in terms of the arguments being raised. First of all, it's called a post-conviction petition, meaning he already went through his regular appeal process. Those appeals were denied. He still has what's called a post-conviction petition, which is what we're talking about now, where you normally would raise arguments that relate to constitutional failures, not getting a fair trial. You could raise an issue such as excessive pretrial publicity, how that impacted the juror, whether you got a fair jury panel, etc. The issues, though, he's raising that I've seen is he's taking issue with the medical testimony and saying that, you know, that didn't prove him guilty beyond a reasonable doubt and attacking. There was sort of one medical expert and then there was a bunch of other medical opinions that also came into play. So he's attacking the medical aspects with relation to cause of death. But when I see the arguments he's raising, they seem to go more to the sufficiency of the evidence against him versus a constitutional question or a trial error. So I think he's probably got a difficult, you know, road to hoe here. But if he were to win, the outcome would be likely a new trial rather than a reversal of his conviction.
And, you know, with the politics of this case, you know, again, I like to think that judges are dispassionate and don't pay attention to that. But I think it would be very hard for any court, any appellate court, or any individual in an appellate court to vote in favor of overturning that verdict. That could be a very, very unpopular decision.
I agree with you 100%. I mean, we always say judges are going to be as objective as possible, but to pretend that they're not influenced by public opinion, they don't have any concern with what the opinion of the public will be when they hand down a particular sentence. I mean, look at a case just like Madigan. If he would have gotten 1 year, there'd be a crazy, enormous public outcry.
Right.
You know, so they have to be cognizant of those things. They still have to do their job, but they're human. And so they have to take that into account. And I cannot believe that it doesn't influence them in some way. But, you know, the judges on your show would probably say something differently.
They absolutely would. Let's turn to the issue of the military. Our military has killed 83 people in what has been deemed to be unprecedented strikes on what are alleged to be drug boats near Venezuela, off the coast of Venezuela. And media reported that just recently the defense secretary gave an order to kill everyone on board a boat, and there was a strike, and apparently there were two survivors. This is all being reported in the news, and he gave the orders to strike again. And the question is, does this violate international law? And I guess we should just assume those facts for purposes of this conversation, because we don't know the facts right now.
Correct. I mean, we can all agree, and it's been publicly reported, and I don't think the DOJ or Pentagon or executive branch disagrees that there were two strikes, that there were two survivors, and that they struck them again. The only thing that seems to be in contention is who gave the order, whether it was Hegseth or someone else, to make the second strike. So it goes to the broader issue of, you know, who has the power to declare war? Because the Trump administration, on the one hand, has basically said this is a war against these drug boats and cartels from other countries, which Congress only has the authority to declare war. And then they've said, well, it's self-defense because these people are attacking our country, so we're just acting in self-defense. But the real problem is that, you know, just because there's a drug boat in the water somewhere in the world doesn't mean that the U.S. interests are necessarily affected, right? To draw the leap that any drug boat anywhere is carrying drugs that are come to the U.S. is, in my view, a little far-fetched, and there's no evidence to support it. Of course, we know cartels run certain routes and are engaged in certain areas. So it's a very controversial issue with Congress now wanting to question Hegseth and the commanders.
Both sides of the aisle.
Yeah, figure out, like, what happened, why? Because, you know, from our rules of engagement, striking people who are essentially defenseless, present no risk, that's not something that normally is done, and a lot of people would argue it's a violation of international law.
Absolutely. It is interesting, and someone likened it to, you know, the police are looking, you know, around the streets, and they see someone who looks like a drug cartel in the city of Chicago and just takes out a gun and shoots. I mean, there's got to be some process. There's got to be some type of process there. And again, no one wants to be sympathetic to people who are fueling our drug problems in this country. But again, by just making an assumption, that just seems to be against kind of what we stand for. But
yeah, I mean, it's a great point. What's the difference between just gunning someone down on the street who's a member of a cartel versus doing international waters? I mean, the argument is that's pretty much the same conduct. So very troublesome issue, and I think we're going to get some hearings coming up because of it.
And Michael Leonard, thank you so much for joining us on your birthday. I hope you have good plans tonight, maybe.
Well, my wife had a surprise party for me like a week ago, so I feel like I've already fully celebrated.
Yes.
But I really hope the ultimate gift is the Bears win over the Packers.
Oh, okay. Well, let's see what we can do about that. And happy birthday, and we will see you next time this year, but probably we're going to get you on before that, because I love how you cover these topics and make things really explainable for our listeners. And one last time, give us the telephone number where you can be reached.
Yeah, 312-380-6559, Leonard Trial Lawyers. And Karen, great to see you. Thanks for having me on.